And welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to this segment of the Hagman & Hagman Report. I'm Doug Hagman with Joe Hagman. Together, I like to call us the America's premier investigative reporting team, of course, father and son. Before we get into our segment, into our program, I want to mention that portions of the nice broadcast brought to you by WholeTonesAlive.com. And we mentioned this earlier, and Michael Terrell is going to be on our show tomorrow and talking about the different frequencies of the Bible and how different frequencies affect and can affect, for example, your moods. Now, we're not talking about some New Age thing. No, not at all. We're talking about sound biblical principles. Folks, music, one of life's greatest pleasures. It's got tremendous power. It's got the power to bring a tear to the eye or quiet a racing mind. Music has the power to heal and has been used through the ages to treat depression, to create energy, to induce sleep, to relieve chronic pain, to reduce stress, and even cure diseases. Walter Reed is even using music in frequencies. And now, musician and author Michael Terrell, has created Whole Tones, the Healing Frequency Music Projects. Did you hear what I said? The Healing Frequency Music Projects. WholeTonesLive.com. Whole Tones, the Healing Frequency Music Projects. These frequencies, they were studied in the music of King David and believed to have astounding healing effects. Now you can benefit from the revitalized ancient healing of music therapy simply by listening daily to this music in the comfort of your own home, in your own car, in your office, which I should do more, according to Eric, the tech, who just said, hey, you just held up a DVD or CD saying, you know, play this, and maybe you won't be so grouchy. It's a new year, folks, so reward yourself with a gift of healing and transformation. Don't miss this opportunity to get an absolutely free sample of this music, so you can begin benefiting right away. Support this broadcast. Support this show. Go to WholeTonesLive.com. And folks, get a free sample of these soothing, relaxing, revitalizing musical tones. Go to the URL, WholeTonesLive. That's with a W-H-O-L-E, WholeTonesLive.com today for your free sample. That's WholeTonesLive.com, WholeTonesLive.com. Now, it's my distinct honor and pleasure to bring forth, folks, buckle up. Make sure your seat backs and tray tables are in their full upright and locked position, because we've got a guest of guests tonight. A guy that I've followed for a long time. Some might say stalked. However, no, I really haven't, but just followed his work. He's done amazing work. Peter Lavenda. PeterLavenda.com, just like it's on. In fact, just go to our YouTube channel if you're watching us live. It's right there. BTR is right there. Our website, HagmanandHagman.com, it's linked there. Peter Lavenda, he's the author of a number of works on political subjects in particular. And I have read the best work about the Nazis, the Unholy Alliance, the Rat Line, the Soviet spies, the Nazi priests that's just a myth. Oh, the myth of the Nazi priest. Yeah, there's a book by that title. Now, you know, read the research done by Peter Lavenda. I recommend every one of his books, including his really the trilogy, Sinister Forces, book 1, 2, and 3, all different but interconnected, as well as, of course, his Rat Line, Soviet spies, Nazi priests, and Disappearance of Adolf Hitler, Unholy Alliance, and of course Hitler's legacy, or the Hitler legacy, I'm sorry. Welcome, Peter Lavenda. Thanks for joining us tonight.
Thank you for having me. Very pleased to be here.
Well, I'll tell you what, man. And folks watching live on YouTube, now we don't have live video, but there he is there. That's what our guest looks like, and that's a picture of him there. And of course, his books. Mr. Lavenda, we were talking at the break. I just got to ask you this. We're seeing the world basically embroiled in a global jihad. And I've talked about this, and I've cited your books before. Let's start here, and then we can move around which way we want to go. But how did we get here? You wrote about this. You wrote about the weaponization of Islam back in the early 20th century. You wrote about how Islam was used as a political tool, right? A tool of war. And maybe let's start there. Can we do that?
Sure.
All right.
I mean, this is a subject that I think, you know, more people should should become aware of, because it helps put everything into a certain context. Because right now we don't have context. We just know there's all kinds of strange stuff coming at us from all over the place, and we don't know how it started or why, or if there's an intelligence behind it that's controlling this and creating this world instability that we're all so terrified of all the time. This really began, as you mentioned, towards the beginning of the 20th century. If we look at the state of Islam back around 1910 or so, if we look at the Middle East as an example of this, because Islam is spread all over the world, I've spent a lot of time living in Muslim countries. I've lived in Malaysia and Indonesia. I've traveled a lot through other places. I've been to mosques all over the world. And one thing always is reinforced when I start to do a little bit of research, a little bit of digging, and that is that until World War I, the Middle East was fractured. I mean, it was broken into all sorts of pieces. The British had Egypt for the most part. The Italians had Libya. The French had parts of Lebanon and Morocco, Tunisia, Algeria. The foreign powers had pretty much controlled all of the Middle East. They controlled the canal, the Suez Canal. They were in control of the oil fields and all of this. And they kept the different tribes, and at that point we're talking basically tribes in that part of the world except in the cities. They kept the tribes separated at each other's throats. And that wasn't hard to do because they were at each other's throats. There's bad blood between a lot of the groups in the Middle East that goes back for hundreds of years. There's all sorts of antagonisms that they have, hostilities toward each other. There was never anything like a united Islamic caliphate after about the 12th or 13th century, when everything started to fall apart. And the Ottoman Empire came in, basically took over what they could, became the sort of flag bearer of Islam. The religion as well as, you know, Middle Eastern politics. So everything was coming out of Constantinople, Istanbul. And the Ottoman Empire was also fractured. It was in danger of falling apart anyway. And suddenly you have the Guns of August, and you have the assassination of Archduke Ferdinand. In the Balkans, you have this breakdown of the European hegemony. Everybody's fighting everybody else. So you have the British and the French and the Russians basically united against the Germans and the Italians and to a certain extent the Turks. Because what the Germans did, they went to Turkey, they went to the head of the Ottoman Empire and said, help us in our fight against the British and the French and the Russians, and we will support you and we will restore your empire that's been decimated by these other powers. What happened next is critical. Politics is politics. Real politics is real politics. People make alliances all the time. They form, they reform. Nobody really honors these alliances for any great period of time. But there was an archaeologist or a self-proclaimed archaeologist, an amateur archaeologist by the name of Max von Oppenheim. And he considered himself to be an expert on Middle Eastern affairs. He lived in Cairo near Al-Azhar University, the famous Cairo University. He basically had a kind of harem there as well. He wore a fez and a tarbush, and he walked around as if he was a real Arab, which of course he was not. In fact, he's from the Oppenheim family. He was, I think, half Jewish. And he becomes the advisor to the Kaiser of Germany at this critical point when World War I is about to start. And he goes to the Kaiser and he says, look, I'm the expert on Middle Eastern affairs. I know how to get the entire Middle East behind you. We can get the oil. We can close the Suez Canal. We can do all these great things, destroy the stranglehold the French and the British and the Russians have. If we can go and convince the Ottoman Empire, to convince the caliph and the wazir, the advisor, to declare the first ever in the world global jihad. And this will be a jihad that would enlist all Muslims everywhere in the world against the infidels. Against, in this case, very specifically, the English, the French, and the Russian infidels, not the German infidels, thank you very much, but the other infidels. And the purpose behind a global jihad was the fact that the European countries had colonies all over the world, and they had colonies in Southeast Asia. They had Malaysia. They had Indonesia. The Dutch had Indonesia at this time. The British had Malaysia. So these are people who are going to be the enemies in World War I. And what they wanted to do was get the Muslims to rise up everywhere in the world and break the stranglehold of the colonial powers. So the emperor in Istanbul thought, well, this sounds like a good idea. So he goes and he has his religious leader. Remember, this is the religious leader of all Muslims, I mean, at least in an honorary capacity, because there is only one caliphate at this point, and that's in Turkey. And they issued the fatwa declaring a global jihad against the Western powers, against the Allies. Wow. Okay, so this goes out to everyone. Okay, all Muslims everywhere in the world, wherever you're doing, drop everything. We're going to fight all these evil infidels, all these non-believers. Well, didn't quite work out that way, because it sounded good on paper. But when you got down on the street level, when you got down to the ground level where the tribes are fighting each other and bickering, they're not paying any attention to what's coming out of Turkey. In the first place, they hate the Turks. In the second place, they're so divided themselves, they have hostilities going back hundreds of years, pretty much like the Balkans. So you had a complete Balkanization of the Middle East, people who hated each other. You had different religious sects and denominations. You had the Sunnis and you had the Shia, but you had even more fracturizing, is that a word?
Yeah, that works for me.
Okay. And, well, you know what I'm saying. So they were breaking apart even underneath those basic Sunni-Shia, you know, things that we all know about today, but there were many, many more differences of opinion. You had the Wahhabis, you had the Salafis, you had these extremist Muslims in one part of the world. You had people who were much more moderate in the other. Then you had the Ba'athists, you know, in Iraq. You had all these people. Well, the Ba'athists hadn't started yet, but they're going to come out of this period. So everybody's hating everybody else. So the Germans thought they had a lock on the Middle East, and they didn't. You had, if anyone has ever seen the movie Lawrence of Arabia, you'll know what I'm talking about. It's pretty good on some of the details. I recommend going back and seeing it if you haven't seen it, because a lot of the names that come up are, you know, real names in history, and it shows you what was going on politically. So it's useful for that reason. You have the British and the French, and they're making quiet deals with Arab leaders on the side. And they're making a deal, of course, with the Zionist organizations out of Switzerland, promising them a homeland in the Middle East. At the same time, they're promising Prince Faisal and King Abdullah. They're saying all these different stories. They're giving them all these other things they're going to do for them. You know, support us and we'll do this. You'll get your country back. You'll get Arabia back, and you'll have Jerusalem and you'll have Damascus. They're making all these promises that they are never going to keep. Nobody knows this yet, because the British and the French decide we're going to divide up the spoils after the war is over. So you have the famous figure of Lawrence of Arabia, right? And he's uniting the Arab tribes to get rid of the Turks and all this stuff. And it happens. It works. Allenby goes into Damascus, goes into Jerusalem and Damascus. Everything is taken over. The Arabs win their revolt. They're very happy. And Prince Faisal, played by Alec Guinness in the film, is suddenly, you know, told, actually, it's not going to go quite the way that we promised you. We're going to do this. Whoops. We're going to do that. And suddenly Faisal is sitting there thinking, well, at least I have Arabia, right? And they're telling Faisal, not exactly. Now, you have to realize that Faisal was a Hashemite. Faisal's family was in charge of Mecca and Medina, the holy places. Going back hundreds of years, they had the authority there. This was a revered descendants of the Prophet Muhammad. And suddenly they're being told by the British that you're not going to have Arabia. We cut a deal with this other guy. And this other guy was King Saud. And King Saud was a Wahhabi, was a religious fanatic, was a fundamentalist Muslim. But because they cut a better deal with him than they could cut with Faisal, they put him in charge of Arabia. Arabia was never called Saudi Arabia until after World War I. Because King Saud named it after himself.
Right.
Prince Faisal now winds up... Yeah, people don't know this.
No, and folks, did you just... please listen. Please, get, ladies and gentlemen, listen, because important foundational information. If you want to know why we're where we're at, listen to Peter Lavenda, our very special guest, Peter Lavenda, peterlavenda.com. That's linked off of HagmanHagman.com. Prince Faisal said to Max von Oppenheim, 1915, I thank God that the interests of Islam are entirely identical with those of Germany, just as an FYI, but okay. Mm-hmm. You point that out in your book on chapter 2. But anyway, go ahead, sir. Let me interrupt.
So they're cutting deals left and right, and the whole focus of this is, well, we want the Suez Canal and we want the oil. So King Saud was a better bet as far as the British were concerned. There's a lot more internecine struggles that went on behind the scenes there. It's very Byzantine, but in the end, Saud wins this contract, basically. He gets the contract, he gets Arabia for himself, names it after himself. And the reason why you have such a strict regime now in Arabia is because Saud was a Wahhabi and his family are Wahhabis. And Wahhabism is a very fundamentalist strain of Islam. It is not a moderate strain by any means. And in fact, since I have lived in Muslim countries abroad, so I've interacted with Muslims constantly, their feeling towards Saud and towards the Wahhabis is one of distaste. They really don't like these people. They don't like the Saudis. They don't like what comes out of Saudi Arabia. They call it petro-Islam. You have the Saudis setting up mosques every place all over the world, spending huge amounts of oil money to do this, and promoting their own brand of Islam, which is Wahhabism. And that does not play very well in Indonesia and Malaysia and other parts of Southeast Asia where you have strong Muslim influence. They don't like this. They reject it. But we're getting ahead of ourselves. So the dust settles. World War I is over. Faisal is sent off to Damascus. He tries to raise a revolt of his own. He gets destroyed. He gets kicked out. They push him over to Iraq, and they make him the leader of Iraq. So Faisal, who has nothing to do with Iraq, winds up running Iraq. So that didn't last very long either, obviously. While all this is going on, there was no such country as Iraq or Kuwait or Saudi Arabia, as we know. All of these countries were created after World War I. And they were created by the British, who basically took this large map of the Middle East and a ruler and a pencil and decided they would draw the boundaries. I'm not making this up. You had Lawrence, T.E. Lawrence, Lawrence of Arabia, and a woman, Gertrude Bell, famous archaeologist, famous adventurer, one of the few Western women who was actually revered by the Arab peoples because of her knowledge and her bravery and all the rest of that. She set up the Baghdad Museum. She did all sorts of, you know, positive things in that part of the world. But between Gertrude and T.E. Lawrence, they get together and they decide they're going to create the map of the new Middle East. Iraq is created. Kuwait is created. Jordan, Lebanon, all these countries, Saudi Arabia. Everything is created with new boundaries that they decided upon, you know, basically in a back room. And the map that we're dealing with today is the result of this very misguided approach, which Lawrence later regretted and wrote that he regretted it and said we screwed up in the Middle East really badly, especially where the Kurds were concerned. So lines were drawn through all the sort of tribal areas. The French had their section, the British had their section, and of course the State of Israel was being created as well in the middle of all of this. Okay, so we fast forward a little bit into the 1920s, and you have Arabs living in what was then Palestine and North Africa, throughout North Africa and the Middle East. And the British and the French have betrayed promises to the Arab revolt. And they've decided they're going to create a Jewish homeland in the Middle East, in Palestine. And it's going to be with Jerusalem and all the rest of it in this very, you know, central area. The feeling among the people at that time living in the Middle East, among the Palestinians, was, wow, this is really true. This is happening. The protocols of the learned elders of Zion is true. There's Europeans and there's Jewish bankers and there's all these people conspiring to destroy us, right? It's as if these predictions are now coming true. We know the protocols of the elders of Zion was a hoax document produced by Russian Secret Service in an attempt to invalidate the Jewish movements that were taking place there, which were, you know, they were flirting with communism, with socialism, with all of this. Karl Marx was Jewish, et cetera, et cetera. So in order to sort of destroy their credibility, they create this hoax document called the Protocols of the Learned Elders of Zion, which is supposed to be a meeting of a bunch of rabbis in a cemetery, and they decide how they're going to carve up the world. Well, this thing gets promoted in the Middle East as a genuine document, and it is today, still today, regardless of what scholars and academics say. They consider this document to be real. And why? They just point to the situation. Well, look what happened, right? So you have this growing resentment now, and it's starting to boil over. The Europeans have betrayed us, and they're associating it with the Jews now, too. So this whole thing is starting to explode. And you have, in the midst of this chaos, a man called al-Husseini arrives. Al-Husseini is very well-connected Palestinian. He has himself declared the Grand Mufti, which is the highest religious leader in Palestine. He's the Grand Mufti. Therefore, his word is golden. He didn't really deserve this degree because he never really got a religious degree. But he, through, you know, machinations, typical sort of Byzantine stuff, he winds up, he's the Grand Mufti. And he basically declares war against the European powers and war against the Jewish settlers who are coming in. And the whole thing starts to explode. You have riots all over Palestine. And as this is going on, Adolf Hitler is coming to power in Nazi Germany. So by 1933, Hitler is in power. And in 1933-34, the Middle East is in a shambles, particularly the Palestinian area. There are bombings, there are assassinations, there are riots on a constant basis throughout the area. So everything is going really, really badly. And al-Husseini looks at Hitler as the sort of the savior of the situation. Just as the Turks did with Germany in World War I, now al-Husseini is looking at Hitler and the Nazi party in general, the Nazi ideology, as something he can work with because they're as anti-Semitic as he is. Hitler is a strong man, which everybody, you know, in that part of the world reveres, the idea of the strong macho guy who's going to solve everyone's problems. He just sort of falls into place. I mean, al-Husseini thinks this is the greatest thing. So he then starts writing letters and making contact with Hitler. And a young Adolf Eichmann, then one of his first jobs for the SS, is that he goes into the Middle East to meet with the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt, to meet with al-Husseini, to meet with the anti-European movements, the anti-English movements there, which are all now becoming religious movements. You know, because the story of Wahhabism and the story of Salafism is that Islam lost its dominance in the world because they lost their spirit, they lost their morals, they became degenerated, they became materialistic, so they lost their principles. And now the only way for Islam to be strong again is to go back to the old ways, the old principles, renew their faith, renew their opposition to the infidels and all the rest of it. That's sort of one of the major themes. The West is decadent, and all these ideas you have are decadent ideas. We have to go back to the way it was in the time of the Prophet. So you have a religious and a political thing starting to mix together, and in the middle of this mix, you have Eichmann bringing back news to Heinrich Himmler, saying we have to work with these people. Himmler likes the idea, and he introduces al-Husseini to Hitler. There's photographs of this. It's a very famous series of meetings, and Hitler realizes, as much as he doesn't like Arabs in general, he thinks they're subhuman, he knows he can work with these guys. And he puts al-Husseini into a villa in Berlin, and al-Husseini starts making radio broadcasts to the Middle East, to the Palestinians, telling them to rise up against the British and against the Allied powers in general. Once again, going back to the same World War I scenario, except that al-Husseini is one of them. He's a revered leader in Palestine. They look up to him. They respect this guy. And so he spends the war years in Berlin making these broadcasts, asking again for a global jihad. The Nazis understood we have to weaponize this religion because we can turn it into a tool against the other powers, the British, against, once again, the British and the French and the Russians, the same old enemies. But now you throw the Americans into the mix as well. Well, what happens? Hitler loses the war. But the Nazi party machine does not feel they've actually totally lost anything, particularly not the SS. as far as they're concerned, this struggle will go on as long as it takes. And just because they've lost the war doesn't mean that the fight is over. The Nazis, especially the diehard, the really ideologues in the SS in particular, they can work with the Arabs, especially those who are fighting against Israel. They can understand we have a common enemy, and what we can do is work together to overthrow Israel and to cause the Russians and the Americans to fight each other. This was a major platform, you might say, of the SS after World War II. So a lot of war criminals wound up in the Middle East. We all know about Argentina. We all know about South America. What we don't realize is how many actually wound up in Egypt and in other parts of the Middle East. Nazi scientists wound up in Egypt developing weapons of mass destruction to use against Israel. You had Nazi commandos and terrorism experts in the sense of creating terror, training Palestinian commandos to go back into Israel and to blow things up. Otto Skorzeny, very famous guy, Hitler's favorite commando, huge guy, very tall, very big, never say die kind of guy with a tremendous amount of spirit. He manages to escape Allied custody at the end of the war, and he winds up in Spain for a while, Franco's Spain. Franco protected a lot of Nazis before, during, and after the war. And then Skorzeny starts finding himself in Cairo, setting up commando training schools for Palestinians to go and attack Israel. Once again, it's not just a question of guns. It's not just a question of commando tactics. It's also ideology and training. It's anti-Semitism turned into a pure science, a pure political science, in a sense. So you have the Palestinians who feel that they can work with the Nazis because of their shared distaste for Israel. To the Nazis, it's pure anti-Semitism. To the Palestinians, for some, it's anti-Semitism. For some, it's just anti-Zionism, or they just want the Jews out of their homeland. No matter what their religion is, they don't want the Europeans there. It doesn't matter. The Nazis know how to manipulate all sides of this equation. So you have very many famous Nazis setting up shop in Cairo and converting to Islam, by the way. Suddenly they all have Muslim names, you know, which helps cement their relationship to this new terrorist network that they're creating, and they're creating it worldwide, not just in Cairo against the Jews, but they're creating it all over North Africa, all over Africa, all over South America, all over Asia. They are creating a kind of Fourth Reich, and they're doing it with the expertise that they gained fighting in World War II.
Isn't that amazing? I mean, folks, you talk about the relevance behind what we're seeing now, the history that is so clear to me anyway now, that, you know, I mean, we often say there's nothing new under the sun, the same tactics, but hopefully, I mean, you can see, folks, you can see the groundwork that has been laid to where we're at today. I just found the spread of the Nazi ideology and the conjoining between Islam and the Nazi ideology. I thought that was amazing. And in your book was the, I did not know, for example, that the SS, or I believe it was the SS, or correct me if I'm wrong, the Nazis had a platoons or brigades or whatever you want to call those of Muslims, and they were pretty feared.
Sure, there was the Waffen SS, the Bosnian Mountain Division, the Hanchar Division. These right. were Muslims who were working for the Nazis, and they were being blessed by al-Husseini, the guy from Palestine, the same guy. There's photographs of him blessing the troops. These were Muslim Waffen SS divisions who were out there in the field fighting in the Balkans.
All right. And folks, we're talking with Mr. Peter Lavenda. I should call him Professor Lavenda, really. PeterLavenda.com. That's LEVENDA. PeterLavenda.com. It's right off of Hagman and Hagman.com. He's been so gracious to be with us tonight, laying the foundations for where we are today, the global jihad that we're seeing, and of course what others talk about in terms of the Nazification. Maybe that's not the right word, but you know how the Nazis have advanced in the political environment that we see today, and how they kind of survived. And you know, as you're talking about the Nazis going to various countries, including Egypt and others. The rat lines, I mean, the support that they had after 1945 was just amazing. Well, during the war and after the war was amazing. But before we get into that, I got to ask you this, okay? Have you seen the, and pardon me if we're skipping around too much, but have you seen the recent History Channel documentaries on Hitler with Bob Baer from the CIA and another couple of guys going out looking for Hitler in Casino in Colombia? I think it's Casino, Colombia area. Are you familiar with that?
I'm familiar with it. I haven't watched all the episodes, but since I did a lot of work in that area myself, I kind of would check it out once in a while and see where they're going. But yeah, they were down in Argentina, I believe, which is where
Argentina. Yeah. I'm sorry. Okay. Yeah, and you know, as far as I'm concerned, you had really long before they had ever showed up on the scene, you had really investigated the heck out of this, and I thought it was just amazing. And we're seeing more and more information about Hitler come out, and of course after the wall came down, and you know, obviously Hitler didn't die in 1945 outside the bunker, or at least there's no, let me rephrase that, as an investigator I should know better, there's no evidence to support the death of Adolf Hitler in or outside of the bunker, pursuant to the claims of the Russians or anyone else, or you know, right. Pursuant to any claims, right? So the Hitler legacy, which kind of dovetails with what we're talking about, I followed your investigation, and I'm fascinated by it, about what you think or where your trails led with respect to Hitler, because I think, man, you got to be right. Is this a good time to talk about it, or do we need to like talk about something else? Okay, go ahead.
We can connect this because it's all part of a piece of this whole thing, you know. One of the reasons we have to learn what we learned during Watergate, which was follow the money, right? That famous phrase. At the end of World War II, when the Nazis are dispersing throughout the world, one problem that the Allies had was in trying to locate the gold and all the rest of the stuff the Nazis had stolen. They had been shipping this stuff out of the country, out of Europe even, as early as 1944 when the handwriting was on the wall. And they knew everything was falling apart. Remember, D-Day was in June. In July of 44, there was the assassination attempt on Adolf Hitler, which almost succeeded. From July 44 until the end of the war, Hitler did not make any public appearances. You just didn't see him. For the most part, he was hiding. He eventually wound up in Berlin at the Berlin bunker and was hiding down there. During this time, the SS was making all sorts of arrangements to get their ill-gotten gains away from the Allies as much as possible. A lot of this gold wound up in Swiss bank accounts, where it was really safe. No, the Swiss were not cooperating with the Allies, no matter how many times you might hear them differently. The Swiss simply did not cooperate with the Allies in this case. And a lot of the gold that wound up in the Swiss banks wound up financing global jihad, wound up financing the Palestinian liberation movements in Palestine, as well as liberation movements in Algeria against the French, on and on. So this money was around. It was being sent by submarine in some cases. We know that 40 tons, it's a documented thing, it's not speculation, 40 tons of Nazi gold wound up leaving Portugal from the Bank of Portugal, where it had been stored, and wound up sailing to Macau. Macau, of course, at that time was a Portuguese colony in China. 20 tons of that gold wound up in China. We don't know what happened to it. Another 20 tons of gold wound up in Indonesia. When we talk about the Nazis and we talk about Hitler and we talk about global jihad and all the rest of it, quite often people forget or ignore or are not aware of the role Indonesia plays in all of this. Indonesia is the world's largest, most populous Muslim country. And the population in Indonesia is equivalent to adding together Egypt, Iraq, Iran, and most of the Middle East altogether. We're talking about over 250 million people living in Indonesia. When I was searching the Adolf Hitler story, and it came to me by accident, I was in Indonesia. I was actually studying at Gajah Mada University in Yogyakarta, which is their version of Harvard, and I was taking courses there to get my MA degree, and I heard these stories. People were telling me, oh, did you hear about Hitler escaping to Indonesia? I thought that was pretty funny. this was around 2007 or so when I'm starting to hear the story. And I'm saying, well, no, Hitler died in the bunker in April of 45. I know I wrote about it in Unholy Alliance. I mean, there was no question in my mind that Hitler died in the bunker, in the Berlin bunker. But they're saying, no, he escaped. He escaped. He wound up in Indonesia. And I thought, yeah, right, okay. A little later, somebody that I know, Dr. Nick Melantoni, who's the state archaeologist of Connecticut, went to Moscow to look at the skull the Russians claimed was Hitler's skull. And he came back, and we had a discussion about this, but of course he became well known for doing a participating in a documentary on this on the History Channel. He discovered that skull was not even the skull of a man, it was the skull of a woman, the wrong age, and they did some testing on it, on a particle, a piece of the skull that he brought back with him, and the testing shows that had nothing to do with Adolf Hitler. The skull the Russians have been saying all these years was the skull of Hitler is not. And when that happened, I sat back and I thought to myself, well, then wait a minute. What forensic evidence does exist that Hitler died in the bunker? Maybe I better look at this Indonesian story a little bit more closely. And then I started seeing documentation. People were showing me papers about this. They were showing me all sorts of strange documents in German that were found, that were in the possession of this weird guy who lived on this remote island in Indonesia, you know, far to the east of Bali. I mean, we're talking remote, very difficult to get to. And I'm putting this together and I'm thinking, you know, there's something to it. I mean, in this guy's writings, he's referring to Krunoslav Dragonovich, which is a mouthful. But Dragonovich goes back to what you were saying before. This was the man who created the rat lines. This was a Croatian priest, a Catholic priest, who tried to save the entire Croatian puppet government, the Ustashi puppet government that were Nazis, tried to save them, to move them out of Croatia where they were going to, about to be arrested, got them out through northern Italy, through the monastery route, as we call it now, through a series of churches and convents and whatnot, got them fake papers, and got them on a ship going to Argentina. They were some of the first war criminals to have escaped and wound up in Argentina using the monastery route, using the rat lines. It's Dragonovich who created this, and he created it working hand-in-hand with Allied intelligence. When the war was over, the CIC, the Counterintelligence Corps, had a base in Salzburg, Austria, and he worked with them out of that base. At first, the Americans wanted to capture Nazis and prosecute them. But by 1946, going into 47, everything changed. They knew they were going to have problems with the Soviet Union, so they were looking for Nazis not to prosecute them, but to hire them and to protect them, to make them work for Allied intelligence. So suddenly, Dragonovich, this crazed Nazi monsignor in the Catholic Church, a defender of Nazism, a virulent anti-Semite and anti-communist, suddenly becomes basically a guy working for the CIA. First for American military intelligence, then for the CIA. Now he's moving people out of the country like mad. Josef Mengele got out this way. Fritz Stangl got out this way. Klaus Barbie, all the big names of the Nazi hierarchy, the most wanted war criminals, got out with this man's assistance, with Dragonovich's assistance out of Austria. Now I'm looking at some old papers. I'm in Singapore and in Indonesia. I'm looking at some old documents. I mean, the originals, not just photocopies. And I'm looking at this guy talking about Dragonovich. He has the address, where to find him in Rome, where to find him, where the safe house is in Genoa. He's got all of this information. This old guy who died in 1970 in Indonesia, he had all the documentation on the rat lines before anybody knew the rat lines really existed. This was before Klaus Barbie had been arrested in the 1980s, when suddenly everybody heard about the rat lines, and Dragonovich, the name Dragonovich, became famous. This paperwork dates back to the 1940s. This guy got out of Europe, wound up in Indonesia, the same age as Hitler, the same height as Hitler, with a handlebar mustache, and with his blonde wife. And they wind up in Jakarta around 1952. And then from Jakarta, they wind, Jakarta, of course, is the capital of Indonesia. From there, they wind up on this remote, remote island called Sumbawa Besar. And it's in the middle of nowhere. And he winds up there running a clinic, a medical clinic. Now, this freaked me out for another reason. You've read Unholy Alliance, so you know that in 1979, I went to Chile. I was detained by a group of Nazis down there at a place called Colonia Dignidad. And yeah, Colonia Dignidad, yeah, of course, is rather famous now. I mean, it's becoming more famous. People are talking about it. But in those days, their claim to fame for the local people was they ran a clinic, right? So they ran this clinic on their estate, this vast estate they had in the Andes Mountains. And these were Nazis. These are people who had escaped justice. They served as a safe house for people like Walter Rauf, Otto Skorzeny, Josef Mengele. Everybody had passed through Colonia Dignidad at one point. It was a beautiful place, idyllic, in the middle of nowhere, and protected by the Chilean government. So I had blundered into the place in 79. That's another story. But the idea that they ran a clinic, and now this guy's running a clinic on this island, this kind of weird coincidence started to make me pay attention. And as I started digging and I started digging, I came to the conclusion that whether or not this guy was Hitler, he was somebody. He was some famous war criminal. He was somebody that they were looking for, someone that had to be found. And it led me into the story about Hitler's escape, the possibility that he did escape. And then I started researching the British files on this, the American files, all the historical statements that have been made, newspaper clippings, and all the rest of it. And I came to the conclusion that there's absolutely no way to know for sure that Hitler died in the bunker, that the story we were told was told by British Secret Service, a guy called Hugh Trevor Roper, a famous historian who, by the way, didn't speak German, did not have access to the American or the Soviet German prisoners from the bunker, only to the ones the British had. And he had 3 months, only 3 months, to come up with a story that Hitler committed suicide in the bunker on April 30th, 1945. He's dead. Nothing more to see here. Move along. He was given that job. He had 3 months to do it. And he did it in 3 months, made a big presentation. We have discovered, you know, to our satisfaction, Hitler died in the bunker. No problem. He's dead. Forget all about it. Don't go looking. Well, yeah, but no. The eyewitness reports were all contradictory. Okay? Even the British, their own people couldn't agree. And then when you started matching it to what the prisoners, the Americans had, the prisoners the Soviets had, who changed their story completely with every beating and interrogation, and suddenly you realize nobody said anything. I mean, what possible reason would the SS have to lie about Hitler's death, right? Of course they're going to lie about it. They're going to lie like crazy. Oh, he took cyanide. Oh, he shot himself. Oh, somebody else shot him. On and on, all these stories came out.
Or we heard the gunshot. We did, honest.
We did. We heard it. We heard a gunshot. Yeah. It's World War II. It's Berlin in April 1945. You heard a lot of gunshots. You know, it was constant. It was a rain of bullets going on out there. So, you know, the story was they cremated the bodies. The Soviets came, however, SMERSH, the famous counterintelligence people for Soviet military, they came and they claimed they found the bodies. Well, they found Goebbels and his wife and their 6 children and their dog. And
nice
they found
touch.
Those bodies. Nice touch.
As
and,
you put it.
Yeah. So they touched, they got those bodies. Then they claimed they had Hitler and Eva Braun. The problem with that was the first body they came up with was not Hitler. It was Hitler's double. Hitler had 2 doubles that we know of because, as I say, he did not appear in public after July 44. But a double would occasionally appear. Somebody kind of looked like Hitler and then disappeared again. So they found a double. They found another double in another town. They didn't really find Hitler, but they found these bodies. The identification that this is Hitler and Eva Braun is made on the basis of dental records, which is pretty funny because 2 weeks before the end of the war, Adolf Hitler and Eva Braun decide they have to go to the dentist and get new dentures made. So they go to the dentist. I mean, the war is falling. Everyone's dying. They need new dentures. So they go and they get dentures. But they get 2 sets each, 2 sets of dentures each one. One set was found in the mouths of these 2 corpses that they found outside the Reichschancellery in Berlin. They didn't fit. but it didn't matter. The Soviets were satisfied, oh, this must be Hitler and Eva Braun. But let's go and let's make sure. Let's find the dentist who did that. Well, they couldn't find the dentist, but they did find somebody who worked for the dentist and from memory drew exactly what the denture should have looked like, right? This guy, you know. So
how convenient.
How convenient. And the, yeah, you know, right, the drawings work. They're perfect. Of course, this must be Hitler and Eva. Where's the other set of dentures, right? No one knows. Two sets of dentures, but only one was found. Well, the Soviets now take up these bodies, and this is the weirdest thing of all. They drive around with these bodies in the back of a truck for like days and days. They'll drive someplace, they'll bury the bodies, day or so later, come back, dig them up, drive them around again. This is in the Russians' own documents, their own words.
Right.
You know, this is the Hitler book that they put out a couple of years ago. So they're driving these bodies around like crazy. So they finally decide to bury the bodies once and for all in Magdeburg at the KGB headquarters there. There's a parking lot. They bury them in the ground. They pave it over. And now there's the new Soviet intelligence headquarters for that part of Germany, East Germany, at Magdeburg is there. And now the bodies are there. Everybody can forget about them. It's done. Okay, go back to Indonesia. Why is this important, the story? Because in January of 1970, our man in Germany, this strange doctor who's not really a doctor, breaks his habit of never leaving the island. He never leaves that remote island. He's paranoid about the Allies. He decides he's going to go, for some reason, to the city of Surabaya on the coast. The story given doesn't make any sense. He has a patient, and the patient is having heart trouble. He wants to take the patient to this hospital in Surabaya. However, there's a note left behind in his belongings that says he has a meeting with somebody at a hotel in Surabaya in January of 1970. We don't know what this is all about. He winds up in Surabaya, a guy who never wanted to leave that island because he's paranoid for security. On the day he arrives in Surabaya, he winds up himself in the hospital. No one knows how he suddenly got sick. The next day he dies. I'm working on the assumption he was summoned to Surabaya by someone on some pretense and murdered, quite frankly, killed in Surabaya. Whether it was Mossad doing this because they knew who this guy was, who knows? But right, he was called up there and he dies. I mean, he was fine as long as he stayed on his island. He was right. If he left the island, he would be killed. He left the island. He died. That's in January of 1970. By April of 1970, Yuri Andropov, now head of the KGB, before he becomes premier of the Soviet Union, Andropov is head of the KGB. In April of 70, he gives the order to his people, go to Magdeburg, dig up the bodies of Hitler and Eva Braun, and cremate them again and sprinkle the ashes in the river. Shortly after, word comes to Russia that this guy has been murdered in Indonesia. Suddenly the KGB is in a hurry to destroy this evidence that everybody forgot even existed, right?
That's right.
Andropov says, go and dig up these bodies. Actually, tear up the parking lot, the paved parking lot. Dig down, get these bodies, which have now been decomposed to the point where it's disgusting. And they're going to take them and take them out to a place and burn them, cremate them again. But do it right this time, you know, and then you know, scatter the ashes. That's in April of 1970. So what is going on? What is all this? It's a very suggestive story. And as I started researching more and more, it got more and more crazy. It involved gold. It involved what's something called Sukarno's Revolutionary Fund. It was gold being shipped around to support a sort of competitor to the IMF and to the World Bank that was going to be run by Sukarno and his non-aligned nations, you know, neither the communists nor the capitalists. He was going to create this sort of operation that they wouldn't have to rely upon the IMF. All of this politics was going on all around the same time. You know, so this is, you know, Sukarno's overthrown in 65, the year of Living Dangerously. Suharto comes in. He's trying to get a hold of the Revolutionary Fund. All of this is going on. But in the middle of all of this, in 65, that famous year when they made a movie about that too, in which, you know, Sukarno was basically overthrown because the generals believed he was working with the Chinese communists to take over the country and turn it into a communist state. During that same year, our guy in Germany, this strange Austrian guy with the handlebar mustache, goes to Bali, the famous island of Bali, a beautiful resort island, and spends time there in Bali, coming back and reporting how great everything was and how beautiful it was, and he was glad to find, to meet some of his old comrades. Well, in 1965 in Bali, records coming out of that part of the world say that tens of thousands of people were murdered during that massive purge that took place in 1965, the anti-communist purge. Tens of thousands. Estimates go as high as 100 or 200,000 people were murdered on the island of Bali alone. And that's the time he decides he's going to go to Bali and hang out. Right? So the connection between this man, whoever he was, and the Indonesians, many Indonesians swear this was Hitler, the connection between this guy and the destruction of communists on the island of Bali and his access to the gold that was supposed to be used for the Revolutionary Fund, Nazi gold, all of this comes together to suggest that we may be talking about Hitler. And if not Hitler, then somebody who had Hitler's contacts, had Hitler's access to funds, and was just as ideologically fanatic as Hitler was, and who had the same mustache, quite frankly.
And he also had, this being the same person in Indonesia, and you mentioned his address book, his, East flyer, Rudel?
Rudel? Hans Ulrich Rudel, yes.
Right, okay. So, I mean, motive, means, opportunity, methods, everything, basically to get to where he needed to go. And then, of course, and I found this fascinating too, folks. If you think about this, 1965 Bali, think about what happened there, the purge of the communists, and then, of course, the strange, as you point out, the strange situation in 1970 with surrounding this man's death. And you identify this man in your book. And again, his book, in this particular book, The Hitler Legacy, you identify him by name, and also you show a picture of his gravesite, too, right? I mean,
Well, yeah, I went to visit the grave because I wanted to see it for myself. He was buried right there in Surabaya. You know, Muslim tradition is you bury a body within 24 hours. They weren't going to ship him back to his island, so they buried him there in Surabaya. And what is bizarre about his gravestone is that it was missing the dates. So you have the name. His name allegedly was Georg Anton Poch. That's P-O-U-M-L-A-U-C-H. And they had him there as doctor, because he was posing as a medical doctor if he wasn't a doctor. So he had his name Dr. Georg Anton Poch, and then birth date blank. Even the date of death blank. Nobody put in the dates. Now there's not a single gravestone in that cemetery, and it's a big cemetery, and I walked it. There's no gravestones without dates on them. It's just not the tradition. And this was a traditional Muslim gravestone. The dates are missing. That's spooky. That's not done. That's incredible. They didn't.
Are we to believe? You said there was a Muslim cemetery. Are we to believe that this man became a Muslim?
Oh, he did. He converted to Islam. His wife, this nice blonde Austrian lady, after a while decided she had had enough of Indonesia or Sumbawa or whatever. And in 1964, I believe it was in 64, she leaves the country forever. She goes back to Europe and disappears. Quite frankly, haven't been able to find her since. But about a year later or so, around the time of the Bali massacre, he marries a local Indonesian woman who is Muslim. Now, Islamic law says a Muslim man can marry anyone. She doesn't have to be Muslim as long as the children are brought up Muslim. But
can you hold that thought? We're at the top of the hour break. And this would be a great place to break and pick up on the other side. Hitler escaping to Indonesia and becoming Muslim.
Yeah, I'm telling you, you got to read this book, The Hitler Legacy. Fantastic documentation.
We'll be right back, folks, on this Monday edition of the Hagman and Hagman Report with our very special guest, author Peter Lavenda. His series of books, Sinister Forces, as well as Ratline, Unholy Alliance,
and The Hitler Legacy, which we're talking about right now.
it's very informative and a different perspective than what the mainstream historians and people have told us. So stay with us. We'll be right back with Peter LaVenda.
This is the Global Star Radio Network.